Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case is here on the government's petition for review of a decision of the Third Circuit construing 28 U.S.C. 2401B, the statute of limitations provision of the Federal Tort Claims Act. Under that provision, a tort claim against the United States is barred if it is not presented in writing to the appropriate federal agency within 2 years after the claim accrues. The question in this case is whether a claim for medical malpractice under the Act accrues when a claimant knows both the existence and the cause of his injury, even if he does not know that the injury amounted to medical negligence. The facts are not here in dispute. Respondent entered a VA hospital in April 1968 and was treated for an infection of the femur of his right leg. Treatment consisted of a deep surgical incision followed by treatment of, by drugs, including irrigation of the wound with a solution of neomycin sulfate for about 13 days. In June, respondent noticed a ringing in his ears and some loss of hearing. An ear specialist whom he consulted in August diagnosed his condition as bilateral nerve deafness. Another ear specialist, Dr. Joseph Sadeloff, whom he visited in November, wrote for his VA records and discovered that he had been treated with neomycin. In January 1969, Dr. Sadeloff told respondent that it was highly possible, or words to that effect, that the neomycin treatment had caused his deafness. In April 1969, respondent, who had been receiving VA disability benefits for a back injury, filed a claim seeking increased benefits for the injury to his hearing. He asserted in this claim that his deafness resulted from medication given him by the VA, and he cited Dr. Sadeloff's opinion as the basis for this assertion. A VA board of physicians denied the claim, stating, among other things, that the treatment, that the deafness was not caused by the neomycin treatment and that the treatment was not negligent. Respondent vigorously disputed this denial of causation over the next several years, writing letters and claims and explaining why it was caused by neomycin in the course of appeal and remand proceedings before the VA respecting the disability benefits claim. In May 1971, while those proceedings were going on, the VA sent him a report, a supplemental statement of the case that included a report by a VA investigator. And this report stated that one of the doctors whom respondent had consulted had said that his deafness might be attributable to his previous occupation as a machinist. Respondent confronted the doctor who had allegedly made this statement, Dr. Soma, and Dr. Soma denied the statement attributed to him and told respondent that neomycin had caused his deafness and that the VA doctors should not have given him that drug. The Court of Appeals, affirming the district court, held that respondent's tort claim accrued for the first time at this time, June 1971, so that his written statement of claim filed in January 1973 was timely under the Act. The Court's holding is predicated on the view that a malpractice claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act does not accrue until a claimant knows or should know causation, damages, existence of a duty of care, and breach of the duty of care.
And you say it's the event, do you?
No, we don't say it's the event, Your Honor. We accept that in cases where you didn't know you were injured, that it would begin at notice that you were injured by a medical treatment.
Well, the event of known injury.
Yes, of knowledge of the known injury, yes. For reasons I am about to explain, we submit that the rule...
And the cause, you would concede.
That yes,
not
yes.
Not
the next
negligence,
is,
but
of
what,
course.
What act or episode was the causation?
Exactly. As soon as they know the nexus between
right.
causation, between
right.
injury and treatment, we, or should know,
right.
We say that it accrues at that
right.
point.
There's no issue in this case, is there, of concealment or fraudulent concealment or any other kind of concealment?
No, Your Honor. The unless you assume that the VA's denial that neomycin caused it or
well,
their denial of liability.
Is there any claim of concealment or fraudulent concealment?
No, I don't believe so. The VA believed up until litigating that they eventually conceded that there was evidence that neomycin caused the injury and for that reason gave him disability benefits in 1975. But during the time that he was litigating this question for the VA, there's no suggestion that the VA was was sitting on secret knowledge that, in fact...
Or hiding anything from him.
No, I don't believe there's any claim to that. There are complaints that they didn't send complete records to Dr. Sadeloff. They only sent a letter saying, but there's no real claim here of concealment or fraud. Our basic contention in this case is a simple one. When a person knows that he has been injured and that his injury has been caused by a particular course of medical treatment, he is on notice to commence inquiries into the possibility that the treatment may have been negligent. The limitations period in a statute of limitations is the time set aside for making such inquiries and for filing suit if answers to the inquiries reveal the basis for a legal action. In the case of the Federal Tort Claims Act, of course, you don't have to file your lawsuit within the 2 years. You file merely a written statement of claim with the federal agency, including a statement of the amount certain and damages that you're seeking. When a statute of limitations operates to bar an apparently meritorious claim, the result will often strike a court, and certainly a plaintiff, as harsh. But there are nonetheless sound and long-recognized policy reasons supporting such a result. Our review of the legislative history of the Tort Claims Act statute of limitations indicates that Congress enacted and has retained the provision at issue here because it accepts the soundness of those reasons. Statutes of limitations exist because it is the judgment of legislatures that litigation of stale claims is undesirable. With the passage of time, reliable, relevant evidence may disappear, and it is thought unjust to subject an individual suit on even a possibly meritorious claim many years after the incident giving rise to it, when he is likely to find it difficult collecting evidence for his defense. By barring even meritorious claims after an arbitrary period of time, a statute of limitations induces persons with possible legal claims to investigate and litigate them promptly. One cannot expect a person to commence an investigation, however, until he knows of something to investigate. That is the reason that this court in Urey v. Thompson held that the action of a railroad worker against his employer under the Federal Employers Liability Act was not barred when he sued within the prescribed limitations period as measured from the time he first discovered that he had silicosis. It was not measured from the date many years before when the early symptomless stages of his disease began. Not until he knew he had the disease could he begin asking whether it could have been avoided by differently designed or maintained railroad equipment. And whether the railroads had a duty to provide such equipment. To hold that the statute had run before he was on notice to make such inquiries would penalize the worker for what this called blameless ignorance, because he could not know what was inherently unknowable, harm that was inherently unknowable. Excuse me, yes?
Did this ring in the ears, or was that when it happened?
He had ringing in the ears and loss of hearing in June.
Is that when he knew?
Well, we say that his claim ran from later than that. We would say his claim ran from January 1969, which is when, by that time, he was severely deaf, could hear very little, had been diagnosed as having irreversible, almost total deafness, functional deafness, and knew that Niamh...
He was diagnosed with the same people he's got this case against.
This diagnosis was by a private practitioner, an ear specialist whom he consulted.
But he'd been to the VA hospital too.
I thought
he had this running letter business going.
Well, he was writing the VA constantly for the 2 years, denying and disputing
you
mean
their... Every person would say that because I'm getting older and I'm getting deafer, so therefore neomycin is the cause of it.
We would say
would
this
that,
would
that be normal for persons?
This would be quite a different case if he had not consulted a doctor and been told that it was highly possible that the drug had caused his deafness. And then, yes, but he then filed a claim in April stating that the VA medication had made him deaf and seeking benefits on that basis.
What did VA say?
VA denied it, but he was never deterred by those denials. Well, he didn't.
That claim was not and did not have to be based on any negligence, did it?
It's not based on negligence according to the tort standard. The VA standard, they won't compensate an injury if it's an expectable risk of an operation, for example, but they would compensate if it was an unexpected and untoward event, I think, whether or not doctors at that time should have known and so on. In other words, it's not exactly...
Not the same as a...
It's not equivalent to a tort standard, no, Your Honor. And, of course, the rule that the Third Circuit applied in this case is based on their understanding that he knew causation and damages but did not know that it might be legal malpractice. So that's clearly where the rule that's being tested here is based on an understanding that the person knows the harm.
How many courts of appeals are against you on this?
Well, among
all
courts...
But what?
Among courts of appeals that have recited this rule, the Sixth Circuit in Jordan, the Tenth Circuit in Exnicius, the Seventh Circuit in DeWitt, the Third Circuit in this case.
Who's with you?
Well, we say the Eighth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit are with us, Your Honor. But we would say that, in fact, the Kubrick case is the first case that really squarely presents this issue because Bridgeford and some of those other cases can be understood as cases where the plaintiffs might have been confused about the nature of the injury and the connection of causation. For example, in one of those cases, the plaintiff was suffering an injury which for a while he confused with an automobile accident and was not fully aware. The court thought that, in fact, it resulted from an operation that he had.
Did the government try to bring any of those cases that were against you or might have any here on cert?
We have not tried to bring those cases, Your Honor, but I think this case presents the issue much more plainly because we have here so clear an acknowledgement that the person knew causation, and it can't be interpreted in any way as a case that might come under a construction of the rule that the claim accrues at the time that you know injury and its cause.
How do you understand your opponents to apply the rule in terms of knew or should have known that it constituted malpractice? Do they have to take a lawyer's, be advised by a lawyer? Or?
We understand them to be interpreting the rule rather broadly, and we think that the courts below, although they claimed that this had limits and was a very narrow rule, we think that in fact it's really a very broad rule. The court said that one reason, the district court said that it was really only recognizing a rebuttable presumption here. It said that there's a presumption that when you know knowledge and that you have knowledge of injury and its cause, that you would be on notice that there would be possible negligence, but that this may be rebutted in some instances. And they said that in this case, it could be rebutted because the case was technically complex. And I may point out that respondents in their brief at pages 11 and 14 say that medical malpractice cases are often technically complex, and at page 14 they say that laymen generally cannot understand the issue. So I think that really is no limitation at all. And it's quite clear that the district court found that alone enough to rebut the presumption, because the district court said that even in April of 1969, when he first filed the disability claim, at which point the VA had made no denials of causation or negligence, it said that technical complexity of the case alone was enough to allow him not to be on notice of possible negligence. The government says that when you've gone into a hospital for a leg operation and they've given you a drug that makes you deaf, you're on notice that something might have, someone might have erred, and you're on notice to check that out.
Let me just be sure about what you're just now saying. You do not, as I understand you, question the district court's finding that in this particular case, plaintiff's belief that there was no malpractice was a reasonable belief. He expressly found that. And I thought you didn't disagree with that, and that's what we assumed.
Well, it depends on how you characterize that. We say that when this kind of harm and injury occur, you're on notice. You should be expected to believe whether we would quarrel with the word reasonably, I suppose. We would credit the court's findings that he didn't believe it because we can't attack factual findings here.
It's a finding of fact that was approved by the Court of Appeals, and I thought we probably had to start with the assumption that he reasonably assumed there was no malpractice.
I don't think we could accept the word reasonably because
it's in the finding. then you're asking us to set aside a finding of fact.
I think that's a legal conclusion.
Page 29A of the appendix to the...
Yes, Your Honor.
Certiorari.
Your Honor, I'm
really
aware...
It's quite important to know whether you're asking us to set aside a finding of fact or not.
Well, if Your Honor regards that as a finding of fact, we're asking you to set it aside.
It doesn't make any difference whether he
exactly.
believed it or not.
Exactly.
That if, as long as he knew that he was injured in causation, that's enough.
That's enough.
Whether he reasonably believed no malpractice or not.
Yes, perhaps there's a semantic problem here. I'm having...
I could show that he knew he was given this deomycin.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. There's no question about that.
Does the record show that?
Yes, the record does. It's
affirmatively. Oh, I don't need to sign.
In January of 1969, when he was told by Dr. Sadaloff that neomycin...
That wasn't my question. My question was, when it was given to him, did he know it?
Oh, at the time. No, Your Honor, I don't think the record shows that he knew what the name of the drug was at that time.
He couldn't assume it until somebody told him.
No, Your Honor, and that's for that reason we say the statute that the statute did not start to run until the following January. That we're not arguing that the statute started to run when he was in the hospital or even when he first noticed deafness. We think that the rule that this court applied in Urey, and which was taken over by the Fifth Circuit in the Quentin case, is a basically reasonable rule if it's interpreted with the limits which we understand it to have, because we think it's reasonable that one would not be on notice to investigate possible negligence until he's been injured. We submit that the construction given the statute by the Court of Appeals, however, would be wrong as to any statute of limitations that lacks a tolling provisions to permit the kind of delay which the Court of Appeals would permit. And where the limitations provision is, as the provision in this suit is, a condition on a waiver of sovereign immunity, and hence a provision to be strictly construed, we think the construction is clearly impermissible. The courts below, I've noted, suggested that their rule was quite narrow. They said that it was technically complex, and that would be one reason for limiting the rule here. They also said that because the VA denied causation and negligence, this was a reason for saying that he would not be on notice. The denial of negligence, of course, is irrelevant where there's a finding by the court that he knew. The finding of denial of causation is irrelevant where there's a finding by the court that he knew that the neomycin had caused his deafness. And as I say, the Court of Appeals rule is predicated on that understanding. And as to the denial of liability, we would say that in technically complex cases of the sort posited by the Court of Appeals here, a denial of liability by someone who's confronted with someone demanding damages for his injury is to be expected and not an excuse for ceasing any investigations. We will concede, of course, that the court made no finding that although the plaintiff was not deterred by their denials of causation, he was somehow deterred by their conclusory denials of liability. Finally, the courts below relied on the fact that none of the physicians that he consulted ever spontaneously advised him that neomycin treatment was medically negligent. This, however, is not logically a factor supporting the conclusion that respondent did not and could not, in the exercise of reasonable diligence, have known that the neomycin treatment was negligent. It is itself a legal conclusion that respondent had no duty to ask physicians or lawyers about the possibility of negligence once he knew of his deafness had been caused by neomycin. The Court of Appeals is simply using the conclusion in support of itself. And respondent begs the question in a similar manner when he argues in his brief at pages 14 and 15 that what he terms a conspiracy of silence among physicians and difficulties in obtaining access to medical records make it unreasonable to hold that a layman is on notice of possible negligence when he knows only that a course of medical treatment has harmed him. If, as we submit, the limitations period begins running at the time the claimant gains knowledge of the nexus in treatment and injury, it is irrelevant whether physicians are unduly reluctant to accuse each other of malpractice. Respondent's complaint is more logically understood as a contention that Problems in obtaining medical testimony and in gaining access to records make the investigation of medical negligence a long and difficult task, with the result that a proper claim cannot be prepared in the time allotted by the statute. But the remedy for this problem, if the problem exists, is not to devise a rule that relieves the claimant of any duty to inquire into possible negligence, but to extend the limitations period under the Tort Claims Act. And a remedy such as that, of course, may only be given by Congress. In sum, we have in the statute of limitations provision of the Federal Tort Claims Act a provision that must be construed strictly because it is a condition on the waiver of the government's immunity to suit. At the very least, strict construction demands avoiding constructions that undermine the basic policies of the provision. By holding that persons who know or should know that they have been injured by government medical treatment may postpone the operation of the limitations provision of the Act simply by failing to inquire of anyone where the treatment may have been negligent, the Court of Appeals has undermined the policy of encouraging prompt investigation of claims, which lies at the heart of any statute of limitations. We submit that however many Court of Appeals may have been drawn into reciting the rule which the Court of Below has adopted, that they are wrong, and that this Court sits to correct such errors. Accordingly, we submit that the rule was erroneous, that under a proper construction of the provision in the Federal Tort Claims Act, respondent's claim was clearly barred, and we ask that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be reversed.
Mr. Kuby.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I would like to commence my brief remarks against the background of the congressional history found in the 1949 amendments to the Federal Tort Claim Act, where Congress said, "It is not the intention of the federal government to deprive tort claimants of their day in court or of their remedies. Nor, on the other hand, does it propose to encourage delay in the enforcement of claimants' rights or to harass the government by increasing difficulty of procuring evidence." Against this backdrop,
did they change the statute of limitations at that time?
They changed the statute of limitations, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, at that time to a 2-year statute of limitations, but kept the word accrual.
As it was.
As it was. And we are here basically to define the term accrual. And I think in connection with that, it is important to note the factual basis, and I may elaborate a little bit on what the government counsel has said. This was not a simple case. This was a situation where this Korean veteran with an osteomyelitis condition in his right femur was fed for 13 days neomycin sulfate, a 1% solution. He had never heard of this drug before, didn't know anything about it. It was fed in such a way through tubes, through a suction apparatus, with the matter being, the bottles constantly being changed, until he left the hospital. That's all we knew about it. He goes home. He then proceeds to have, in the months to come, a reduction in his hearing. He, in fact, goes back to the Veterans Hospital in Wilkes-Barre. And they finally do audiometric tests on him in June of 1978. While he was in the hospital, they did nothing. Now,
well, he wasn't hard of hearing in the hospital, was he?
He was not hard of hearing in the hospital, but, Mr. Justice Stewart, That, I would submit, and there is no question about malpractice here, there's no question about negligence, goes to the issue of what they were doing for him and what he trusted them with.
Well, I just want to be sure. My question was addressed to only to be sure that I was understanding your argument. You said he went back for audiometric tests, which I suppose are hearing tests.
And that's correct,
while
sir.
While he had previously been in the hospital, they had done nothing, and I want to be sure that I understood that there was no need to give him audiometric tests while he had previously been in the hospital because he wasn't hard of hearing.
But unfortunately, in the negligence aspect of the case, it became abundantly clear that it was necessary to give him audiometric tests when you feed someone neomycin, which has ototoxic effects as well as nephrotoxic effects.
Well, I don't understand either one of those words, but how long does it take you to become hard of hearing?
In this situation, yes. It took a number of months before it started to develop.
That's what I thought.
In the Portis case, another case under the Federal Tort Claims Act, it took years to develop with the same drug.
Both of those cases are not unlike Urey against Thompson with the gradual development of silicosis, are they?
The Portis case, Mr. Justice Rehnquist?
The gradual onset, the long period of time in which it takes to develop the condition for which remedy is sought.
Yes, this is not the type of case such as the classic basis for the courts of this country utilizing the discovery doctrine. And that was the classic case of a surgeon leaving a sponge in someone's stomach or a clip in someone's stomach, and he does not become aware of the injury until he's opened up.
But in Urey, the court said, in what seems to me quite a similar case, that the afflicted employee can be held to be injured only when the accumulated effects of the deleterious substance manifest themselves. That sounds to me like he has to know that something is wrong with him, and it not necessarily when it began to happen, but that he need not know that it was a result of any particular malpractice.
Well, that was not, if I may submit, a malpractice case. That was an FELA case where the standards are different, where in this situation, I would submit that knowing that he has had a loss of hearing developed in a situation where a doctor has told him there is a possibility that it came from neomycin does not set him off in searching. It did not set off this man, and as the court found below, would have not set off a reasonable man, both of an objective and subjective test, in going further when the United States government, through its Veterans Administration, kept saying, one, there is no causation, because our doctors say when you get neomycin topically, through an irrigation process, it doesn't produce these toxic effects. It's only when you get it parenterally. And I'm sure he didn't know what the word parenterally meant, or systemically. That's the typical example
of... You did help him out. Will you help me out? What do you mean by that?
Systemically put into the bloodstream. They were running it in and out of his system. Now, that's just what we're trying to show, and what the courts below and the courts in most of the circuits have said, that in situations where you have a man such as Kubrick, who has less than a high school education, that you look at those things in determining whether or not he utilized reasonable diligence. And that's the standard as to when the cause of action accrues. When by reason of discovery or by reasonable diligence, he should have discovered all the aspects of his claim.
Well, my point was, I know it's the other side, I should ask now. But when, at this stage, should he have suspected negligence?
Because of the complexity of this drug treatment, we submit that he should have not suspected negligence until Dr. Soma told him that it was negligent for the government to have given it to him, and that was in June of 1971, and it was only as a result of the government saying, wait a second, it wasn't what you've been saying for the last 2 years which has caused your deafness, it's something entirely different because you work for RCA up in the Wilkes-Barre area and were subjected to this noise. And he says, no, that's not true. And he had letters from all his prior workers, which are in the court record, which said he had perfect hearing before. And it was then that the government was in effect misleading him. But let me also say this, that the government, not only did it reverse itself on the issue of causation, but reversed itself on the issue of malpractice. In 1975, and I would beg to take issue with government counsel, because the VA regulations provide that you don't get benefits under Section 351 unless, in addition to showing causation, you show that it was done as a result of negligence or medical error. And every time they said no causation, they said no negligence, no medical error, and in his testimony he said, I never believed that they were guilty of medical error. All I knew as a veteran, it's like a service-connected disability. If I go into a veteran's hospital, I'm entitled, as long as there's causation, to get a pension, get an increase on my pension. He never believed that there was malpractice. And he so said in the record.
Well, is his belief the controlling test?
It is a fact that the trial court, who received the evidence, which I submit, Mr. Chief Justice Berger, must be both a subjective and an objective test. In making this determination as to when the cause of action accrued, and I would submit that it must be balanced. It must be balanced with what was the harm to the government.
Well, that sounds like the equitable doctrine of latches rather than the statute of limitations, which is imposed by the Federal Tort Claims Act.
No, but if the legislative history says, on the one hand, we want to give the people of this country their day in court, but we also have to balance it. That was part of the legislative history. And in this case, there was absolutely no prejudice whatsoever because...
Do you think the legislative history intended to amend the Federal Tort Claims Act to substitute a doctrine of latches for the 2-year statute of limitations which it actually enacted?
No. I think the legislative history indicates that At first, it was 1 year from date of accrual. Then it was 2 years from date of accrual. Then, and that was to be interpreted by this court. That's the duty of this court, to interpret what that legal word means, accrual. And I might say that in the most recent case of Steele versus United States, which was published subsequent to the printing of our brief, the Seventh Circuit, in a Federal Tort Claims Act, in differentiating between a medical malpractice case and a case based upon an electrical injury as a result of failure to properly wire parts of O'Hare Airport, made reference, as they made this distinction, because they put medical malpractice cases in a separate area, made reference to the regulations of the Defense Department of this country, which provide under the regulations concerning the Federal Tort Claims Act, in dealing with accrual, under Federal Tort Claims Act, it says, except in medical malpractice cases, a claim accrues on the date on which the alleged wrongful act or omission results in some actionable injury or damage to the claimant. In medical malpractice cases, accrual is postponed until such time as the claimant discovers or reasonably should have discovered the acts or omissions which are alleged to be wrongful. Now, that's what the federal government from the Department of the Army has in its regulations at the present time.
Well, that's their position in this case, too.
Their position in this case is that, if I might, if I understand it, Mr. Justice Stevens, is that the mere knowledge of the happening, not the wrongful act.
No, it's the harm plus the causation. And you have to know what happened and why it happened, but not know it's invaded any legal right. That's what separates you.
That's what separates us. But I think that the reading of this regulation, as the Seventh Circuit makes note of, because it also cites a regulation from the Air Force, which talks about the Hungerford case out of the Ninth Circuit, and says, hey, these two departments of the United States government aren't talking about the same thing.
What's the citation of that? Or the date of it, the Seventh Circuit, and what's the caption?
The caption is 599 F. 2nd, 823, decided June
12, 1979. 823. Thank you.
Is that the opinion by Judge Tuttle, or was his the different, the earlier one?
This is the opinion by Harlington Wood, Jr.
No, I'm surprised you don't refer to the Seventh Circuit case written by Judge Tuttle, where he construed his earlier Fifth.
That's the wit.
That's the wit. Yeah.
That's the wit, sir, which we have included in our brief.
Wisdom, wasn't it?
Tuttle.
I think it was Judge Tuttle.
Was it? And,
I'm corrected, sir.
It's Wisdom.
It's Judge Wisdom.
And the Harlington Wood dissented.
Yes. In this case, however, in dealing with the situation, he says he puts medical malpractice cases in a separate category.
If the government agrees with that, there's no fight about that.
That's right. The only fight is what has to be included in the doctrine of accrual. Is it reasonable for a layman without the medical knowledge to start the wheels rolling, or is it reasonable, and should it be for the district court judge based upon all the circumstances, to make that finding, which is done here and under the cases of this court. If affirmed by the Court of Appeals, it is rarely, if any, explored by this court.
By the way, do you interpret the Ashley case, the Ninth Circuit, to be contrary to your position?
The Ashley case, again, took up the position from just knowing the injury.
Well, didn't it say knew or should have known in that case, that he knew or should have known at that time? That's all you're contending for, isn't it?
I'm submitting, sir, that the Eighth and Ninth Circuit both have adopted this limited discovery rule that whoever the party may be, might be a layman with a fifth grade education, a lawyer with so many years of education, it starts to run when he knows of that injury. All the other circuits knows of the causation. All the other circuits say that's just not enough to open up and to give knowledge to the layman who is injured.
Would you draw a different rule for, or depending on the awareness of the individual? Thus, if the injured person were, say, an otolaryngologist, he might have a shorter period of limitations than your client?
Well, Mr. Justice Blackmun, in the Sanders case decided by the district court here in Washington, said when you're dealing with a nurse, yes, she has special knowledge, and we take that into account, and we say that when she knew about her injury because of that factor, it became known to her or should have been known to her. So in answer to your question, sir, if it were an otolaryngologist, of course.
Then you will not be content with the standard of a reasonable person.
I think the courts have used the standard, those who have enunciated it, of both a reasonable man, the objective standard, and the subjective standard of the person involved, the person such as Mr. Kubrick, who trusted his government.
So you'll have a different result than whether he's a less than a high school graduate, as you describe him, or one who's had 2 years of college. You might have an extra half a year, maybe.
You might have a different result based upon the knowledge acquired by the trial judge in assessing the facts of the case. And as the courts have said, these are to be dealt with on an ad hoc basis. Accrual is to be dealt with on an ad hoc basis based upon the circumstances.
You say that's inherent in a test to know or should have known. Knowledge or...
That is...
The ad hoc, is that your position?
That is the test, Mr. Chief Justice, that we espouse, that for the citizens of the United States dealing with the government, that the basis should be as expressed by the Court of Appeals of the Third Circuit. Now, that is the outward parameter. I would submit that there are many situations where the court will not deal with that, but will, on the basis of the knowledge of who the injured party was, the circumstances, what he knew, then on certain subjects, it will be the knowledge of the injury, the causation. I would feel that the government rested a great trust in Mr. Kubrick, and I would only close by citing from a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case decided over 100 years ago in Menzies versus Dentler, where men naturally trust in their government, and they ought to do so, and they ought not to suffer for it. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Stillman?
If I could.
Very well.
First, with respect to the Department of Defense regulation that was quoted from the Steele case, I would say that that is simply another way of stating the Quinton rule, and we would interpret either one the same way, as consistent with the position we're taking here.
As I may not have heard it correctly, but
as I understood that regulation, it was that the potential plaintiff has to discover the wrongful act.
It's certainly when he has knowledge of the acts alleged to be wrongful.
Of alleged to be wrongful.
Well, the Quinton rule says when he discovers the acts constituting the malpractice, we would interpret either one to mean when you discover the acts which turn out to be provable.
He had to have knowledge of the wrongfulness of the act.
Yes, right. We make the distinction. And it doesn't say discover knowledge of the wrongfulness. Well, we say he was on notice to start finding out in January of 1969 or April of 1969 at the latest. And whether he found out or not during the 2 years is irrelevant.
What put him on notice of that?
Put him on notice simply because he went into the hospital and was harmed by a treatment and knew himself to have been harmed by the treatment.
So the best thing to do from now on
is to consult a lawyer.
Is to find a veteran's hospital suit the day you come out.
I don't think file suit, but I think investigate the basis for a possible suit.
You should investigate. You assume that the medical authorities of the United States government are negligent?
No, we make no such assumption.
Well,
we assume that
I don't think anybody should, do you?
Most people are not harmed by, are not made deaf by.
That's what the respondent says. He trusted them.
Well, we think the decision would rest on different issues.
Going back to the standard for just a moment that Mr. Justice Stewart asked you about.
Yes.
In the Urey case,
yes, Your
Honor. Justice Rutledge wrote, he said the critical time is a specified period of time after notice of the invasion of legal rights.
Your Honor, we would interpret that to mean that he has notice of a possible invasion once he understands the injury.
Notice of the invasion of legal rights, which doesn't that imply knowledge of a possible breach of duty?
Well, of course, in Urey, they weren't focusing on the question that's involved here.
But you did rely on the Urey case.
We do rely on Urey because we think that the facts there are similar to the facts that we say should put you on notice. And I suppose we just interpret that phrase to implicitly
include.
You would
say knowledge, notice of the invasion of legal rights should be paraphrased to say notice of the harm and its cause.
Yes, yes, I think so. Also, as to the VA standard, which he says is negligence, I simply would refer to the court to the VA regulations. And that regulation is printed at page 4, footnote 2 of our brief. And it refers to, says compensation is not payable for either the usual or the unusual after results of approved medical care properly administered in the absence of showing that the disability proximately resulted through carelessness, accident, negligence, lack of proper skill, error in judgment, or similar instances of indicated fault on the part of the Veterans Administration. And obviously, this is a different standard from an error in judgment which you were on, had a duty of care to avoid at the time. So it is a fault standard, but it's not the medical malpractice standard. Finally, I simply would observe that the respondent's explanation of how the rule would work, how accrual would be determined under his test, would simply leave us with no rule at all. There's really no point in having a fixed time if it's going to be some kind of balancing test where you consider the state of mind and the state of education of the plaintiff and whether the government was prejudiced and so on. We would agree with Mr. Justice Rehnquist that if Congress had intended any such test, they simply would have said apply the doctrine of latches, and they clearly have not done that here. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, Mrs. Stillman. Thank you, Mr. Kubi. The case is submitted.